Hey, everybody. Good afternoon. Thank you so much for joining this conversation, a Free Press live stream. And I've been so excited to talk about this topic, socialism, ever since 2 weeks ago, a man whose name you all surely know by now, Zoran Mamdani, a 33-year-old, a self-proclaimed socialist who once literally called for seizing the means of production, won very handily in the New York City Democratic primary to become the next mayor of New York. Now, of course, there's this old saying, I don't even know who to attribute it to, maybe Kyla or Tyler will tell me, that if you're not a socialist before the age of 20, you have no heart, but if you're still a socialist at the age of 40, you have no head. And I've sort of been asking myself, like, is that what's going on here? Is it just young people drawn to this same economic, political worldview, or is there something deeper afoot happening? Is there something particular happening in America right now that is making socialism resurgent once again, especially among the young? And I cannot think of two better people to have this conversation with than my guests today, Tyler Cowen and Kyla Scanlon. Kyla Scanlon is a writer, an economic commentator, and an educator. And importantly for this conversation, she is 28 years old, which technically I think makes her a member of Gen Z. Her new book is called In This Economy, How Money and Markets Really Work. Kyla, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And of course, Kyla is joined by Tyler Cowen, an economist, the author of Too Many Books to Count, and a columnist at the Free Press who just wrote an important essay for us called Why Won't Socialism Die? Tyler, as always, thank you so much for being here.
Hi, Barry. Hi, Kyla.
Okay, the place I wanted to begin was with the most simple question of all, which is, why are young people so attracted to socialism? You're both economists, one man, one woman, one old, sorry, Tyler, not old, but old in the context of this conversation, one young. You both grew up in different contexts, different generations. And I think you might have different insights into what is going on right now. So Kyla, I want to start with you because you're part of the generation that is attracted to socialism right now. There was this Cato survey that came out recently. There's been lots of surveys on this issue that found that something like 62% of young Americans have a positive view of socialism. So what's going on? Is it just that young people are attracted to the idea of free stuff, to put it glibly, or give us the steel man version of the argument? Why are young people right now in America attracted to this worldview?
Yeah, I mean, I largely agree with Tyler's piece that there's a lot of negative emotions. I think Peter Thiel encapsulated it best, as Tyler wrote, where, you know, if the capitalist system doesn't work for you, you're going to go and find other things to believe in. And socialism is oftentimes the alternative. And I think oftentimes people move through the world with emotions rather than logic. And the promises of socialism sound pretty good. Of course, it's the old saying is it's good on paper, not in practice. And so I think a lot of people, young people specifically, are looking at the world around them saying, this isn't working for me in whatever context, and I would like something very different.
Is part of the problem, Kyla, in your view, that people are drawn to the kind of, I don't know, the vibes of socialism more than the actual ideas?
I think so, yeah. I think most, you know, there's, I'm trying to remember this Oscar Wilde quote where he talks about how we're oftentimes more driven by our emotions over our intellect. And I think that's really what happens, especially when you have social media as a vector for political messaging now. Like, it's just so much easier to get wrapped up in the emotions of whatever is being promised rather than the economic reality of it. Like, people are much more drawn to the narrative than the economics, because oftentimes the economics don't work that well, but the story sounds pretty good.
Well, here's some of the things, Tyler, that Zora Mamdani is offering New York City voters. He has called for government-run grocery stores. He has called for rent freezes. He has called for free buses. And that's just sort of the beginning of the list. And as you write in your excellent essay today, these proposals have not created a scandal among his supporters, but occasioned, as you write, tremendous enthusiasm. What's going on here?
I think voters know a lot of those proposals are theatrical more than anything else. They're not going to happen. What a mayor actually controls is a police force and the police commissioners. But he's great on social media. There's something dreamy about him. The wife is beautiful. People are fed up with how politics have been. And if you want to send a message that you want to change, that's the vote you would make. And I think it's not just about socialism. On the right wing, we find a great deal of additional interest in populism and various strange ideas like Curtis Yarvin's monarchy. It's not that people actually crave having a king, but again, they want to send a message like, I'll do anything, I'll say anything, I'll vote for anything, please help, scream.
Okay, before we get into the big argument that your piece is making, I want to just stay for a second on the idea that people don't believe that these policies are actually going to happen. I'm not sure that's actually true. I think that a lot of young people might not think that this whole slew of policies will happen, but that some of them will, and that they'll work, and that they'll actually make their lives better. And I guess I want you guys as economists to contend with the actual proposals here. Explain to people that are seduced by the idea of government-run grocery stores, say, or rent freezes, why they won't actually work in your expert view as economists. Let's start with rent freezes. Why won't that work?
There's no issue where there's more consensus among economists that if you control rent and push down the price below the level where supply equals demand, you get a shortage of apartments. It's hard to find a good apartment at all. Landlords let the apartments and the rental stock deteriorate. Crime goes up. Your city becomes worse. Republicans, Democrats, different groups of people pretty much agree on this. So economists and people who've studied the issue flat out do not support rent control.
Okay. And government-run grocery stores, Kyla, why won't that work?
Well, grocery stores already have pretty small profit margins. And so it's really going after the wrong problem. Like, grocery stores aren't really the issue. It's oftentimes the food distributors who are more of the problem. Like, if you really wanted to solve the cost of food. And so it's not the best way to tackle the big issue of how high food costs have gotten.
Let's imagine a world in which Zora Mamdani wins, I believe the race is in November. Right now, the big political story, of course, is who is going to blink first. Is Eric Adams going to drop out? Is Andrew Cuomo going to drop out? If both of them stay in the race, it's an almost guaranteed Mamdani win because they'll split the more moderate vote. And that's to say nothing of Curtis Sliwa, who's running yet again as a Republican. But let's imagine Mamdani wins and these policies that I think the three of us believe won't actually come to fruition. Let's imagine they do. What would be the big outcome of that economically and politically? Would we see an exodus of sort of top earners in New York City? Like, spell it out, Tyler, for us, what the long-term implications of these policies would be.
The real risk is that New York City is quite revenue dependent on its top 200 or 300 taxpayers. And there's a reasonable chance some of them would leave. Also, many have argued Mamdani is anti-Semitic, anti-Israel, anti-Zionist, however you wish to portray that. And if you had some of those individuals leave, the city would go into a fiscal downward spiral. The quality of public goods would be worse because the city would be collecting less revenue. And in turn, more people would leave. I don't think I have such a dramatically negative prediction, but it just would fray yet again at the governance of the city at a time where it's just been getting back on its feet post-COVID. And there is some risk it could go very badly.
One thing I hear from people that are, let's just say, Mamdani curious is, look, we're in a moment of total political gridlock. People are frustrated. Why not try some of these ideas? What's the worst that can happen? Government-run grocery stores. It's just a pilot of 5 or 6 stores. Why is trying these things so wrong? Kyla, what would you say to a young person that is convinced by that argument?
I mean, I think for me, what's really interesting about this conversation is like how he came about and like how these policies came about. And I think most of these policies are trial runs. Like, they're not like broad sweeping things that are going to impact every grocery store. Like, it's going to happen in phases if it happens at all. And I think for a lot of people, like the policies that he is trying, he's like the inverse of Trump in a lot of ways. He is the closest thing that the left has ever had to Trump. And Trump has tried all sorts of policies too that like you could question the economic feasibility of them. And so I'm not sure, like, you know, how exactly he plans to implement these things. I know it's meant to be implemented in quite small pockets, and ideally he doesn't. Like, these are not economically feasible, but all of it does make sense. It is largely a response to Trumpism.
Let's stay for a moment on that. When you say he's kind of the mirror image or the inverse of Trump, do you mean in terms of his charisma, in terms of sort of blowing open the Overton window of what was considered politically feasible? Draw that out for me a little bit more.
Well, Tyler talked about it at the beginning too. Like, Trump is an outcome of perceived system failure, right? Like, you have economic volatility and cultural fragmentation, institutional decay. And so you get this strongman type figure. And so Mamdani is that version on the left, not a strongman per se, but somebody who's charismatic, who really knows how to run media as Trump does, you know, based on the Truth Social posts that we get. And so I think both of them are operating, you know, if you really zoom out, relatively the same. Policy is quite different, but operationally they're quite similar. And so it makes a lot of sense to me that this is happening and that young people are choosing this path, because I don't think there was a clear alternative outside of this. Like, the status quo wasn't working for young people, and so they chose something different.
I think one of the things, and it's maybe a cope, that people like me, or maybe like you guys, that broadly identify as sort of moderate or in the center, imagine is that people want that. Most people want something in the center. And I don't mean like the muddy middle point between two extremes, but just like less polarization, more of a, you know, mix and match between red and blue in terms of best policies. But I think one of the things that I'm sort of contending with or being forced to reckon with is maybe people don't actually want that right now. And I wonder if each of you can spend a minute sort of diagnosing why the center is so unattractive to people right now. What's going on that is drawing people to Mamdani on the left, or maybe you'd even put AOC and others in that category, maybe AOC when she first came on the scene, and then Trump on the other. What is that the result of, Tyler?
One trend I see is that men and women, especially single women, have increasingly different politics. They don't agree anymore. They have different worldviews. You see this in dating markets, which often malfunction, or apps don't work, getting people married. And more younger men have loyalties to Trump or populism. And younger, especially non-married women, want something that you would call more left-wing. And there's just no convergence, and that shows up in voting. So I don't see that ending anytime soon. I also would add, just as an outsider, you know, I've never lived in New York, but we've thought you're crazy for a long time.
for even choosing to live there?
Yes. So if you're now voting for some crazy guy, we're like, oh, whatever, you know. Oh, government-run grocery stores. You've made much bigger mistakes in the past.
Like choosing to live among the rats? So what is the, like, deal breaker?
Look at your garbage pickup, the amount of money you spend per student on education, and you get worse results than almost any other state. I'm not saying I have the cures, but I do feel like it's your fault. Not you personally, Barry, but you New Yorkers.
Thanks, Tyler.
So your school system's already much worse than government-run grocery stores. That's one way to put it.
Kyle, like, go a little bit deeper for me, because I know you've thought a lot about this, into this point Tyler's making about the differences between young single women and young single men. Why are women generally going socialist and men generally going nationalist populist? What's going on?
Yeah, I mean, John Byrne Murdoch over at the FT has a great piece on this. And then Alice Evans has also done a lot of research on this topic specifically. It's happening all over the world. You know, South Korea is a prime example. I think a lot of it has to do with educational outcomes. So young women are graduating college at higher rates. You know, they're getting jobs at higher rates. And then you have this sense of stagnation, I think, that a lot of young men are really struggling with, where it's like, well, where do I fit into the workforce? You know, I'm not graduating from college. Like, what do I sort of do? And they're seeking out alternatives, like the manosphere online is probably a byproduct, or a cause rather, of some of the things that are going on in terms of political divergence. And so it really boils down to, I think, media consumption and then educational outcomes based on what we're seeing politically in this split.
One listener question from John that I think fits perfectly into this part of the discussion is the pitch from, let's just say, the burning wing of the Democratic Party, AOC, Bernie, Mamdani, et cetera, he's grouping them together. Is it truly socialism that they're offering, or is it just a kind of left-wing populism in your view?
I think it's a notion that we're going to care for everyone, which sounds appealing. I mean, Bernie Sanders has held elected office in Vermont. He did not revolutionize the state of Vermont. The state kept on going. You may or may not like the policies they have, but we've seen this story on the screen before, and it's a bit of a ho-hum. So it doesn't actually feel that risky to vote for them. You send a message, you're siding with some values you might agree with, and in a world where Trump is in the ascendancy and Republicans control three branches of government, well, it feels rather impotent to just vote for some moderate Democrat. So you do something a bit more extreme.
Tyler, your piece, I think, makes it seem like socialism is kind of a reactionary ideology, something that people turn to when the status quo isn't working. But I wondered if you could give me sort of the steel man defense of socialism on its own merits. Like, what are these young, highly educated people seeing that they think has value? Or is it impossible to sort of separate out their dissatisfaction with the status quo in answering that question?
If by socialism you literally mean a system where government owns the capital goods and plans the whole economy, including the grocery store, I feel that's very hard to defend as a whole. It's never worked in any country ever. If by socialism you simply mean social democracy, where a lot is done to try to help people and you lower levels of risk and do something a bit like what the Nordic nations have done, I don't think that would work well in America, but the Nordic nations are pretty successful. You wouldn't say it's failed there. People there are pretty happy. And if your vision of the future of America is to be more like that, while I personally would rather have a more dynamic, more innovative nation, it absolutely can be steel-manned. Again, those are great countries. Just go. You'll have fun. People are pretty happy. Try Finland. It's nice.
Why do you think it wouldn't work in America?
We're too large. We're too diverse. We are the source of the world's innovation. And it's very important that we attract the best and the most ambitious immigrants. And you don't do that by putting out a sign saying, we will take care of everyone. You do that by putting out a sign saying, hey, there's a lot of upside here, but also life is a bit tough. Don't come unless you really think you can make it. And I think we have a very special place in the world to be that nation. And it's been to the benefit of virtually everyone in the entire world, not just America. But if you're New Zealand, I don't think you should arrange your society the way America has. You're not going to attract the best immigrants anyway. You're not going to be that innovative. You're very distant. You should, in fact, arrange things in a manner that's more risk-averse.
Kyla, do you see it as a reaction largely to dissatisfaction with the status quo or just something else entirely?
No, I think it is largely dissatisfaction with the status quo. You know, for the capitalistic system, it works quite well, but it is a little difficult to navigate. And in the United States specifically, we don't really have a social safety net or much of one, and it's increasingly being eroded. And so I think there's like the legible economy that has all the economic data and like GDP is growing and jobs are relatively okay. Inflation is sort of going down. But then a lot of people, you know, interact with the felt economy where they're like, I can't get a house. I'm not progressing in my career. I feel stagnant. You know, my groceries have gone up quite a bit. And so they're looking around and they're saying, well, this system doesn't work for me. Like, what sort of alternative is there? And then they see somebody like Mamdani saying like, well, you know, here are some policies that are different. And like what you want is something different. So like, vote for this. And so I think people are, it's the same reason that people voted for Trump, right? Like he was something different. He was something new. And they're seeking that.
What should be the message from capitalists, either just plain old capitalists wanting to convince people away from socialism because they know where it could lead, or free market inclined politicians? How can they be appealing to people who say, all of the things that we know are true for a lot of young people? I'm saddled with debt. I can't buy a house. Healthcare is crazy. All the things that we know to be true. What could a winning message be to that constituency of people that is saying, screw it, I'm going Mamdani? What is the message that would resonate from young people that capitalism is the best of all the alternatives and actually works to their benefit more than socialism will or does?
If you're looking across the world, you know, which countries do you want to live in or be born into? Say it's a random experiment. Those are the capitalist countries. But if it's New York City, I think the message has to be the city could be done much, much better. So much of the city is a mess. It takes so long to build a mass transit line, for instance. The schools are very bad. A lot of young people just shouldn't live in New York City. Kyla doesn't. There's so many quite rich people who live there. Obviously, it costs a lot to get an apartment. And if you feel that's your birthright, I mean, you probably are going to suffer. So there's so many wonderful places in America. I know that's not what a New York City politician will win by saying, but I think that's the actual truth. People who aren't rich probably shouldn't try to live in New York City.
Can I ask a question? Okay. All right. I always do this to you, Tyler. I always ask questions during. But I'm curious. So, like, when I think of New York, I think of it as kind of like the capitalist mecca of the United States, right? Like, if you can make it in New York, you can make it anywhere. And so, wouldn't the ideal version, and you know, I might be blowing this way out of proportion, but like, wouldn't an ideal capitalist system mean that you can make it in New York? So people that go there who like really want to strive can. So like the people who can't afford it should be able to live there at first. Does that make sense how I phrased it?
I think I understand. There's a lot of places in this country where you can make it, including in the arts. It used to be writers, artists had to live in New York City. They've been priced out. They make it other places. Maybe they visit New York. But if you're very ambitious and you want to try to make it, there's plenty of things you can do. You can live in parts of Brooklyn. You can live in New Jersey, take the train over. It's not impossible. It's just a much tougher life. But that's in part because the city has been so successful as a center for finance that it's not affordable for many people. And maybe we don't like that finance is so important in New York. But again, the creative activity moves elsewhere. Los Angeles, I might add, where you live quite nearby, is phenomenal, not just for movies and television, but for the visual arts and video art and theater and comedy. And that's happened after New York became less livable and then later less expensive. So there's always new places where you can reinvent things.
We have a question that's perfectly timed from Connor here in the audience, who asks, why is it the people that are backing this mayoral candidate are the people that make pretty good money, the champagne socialists, whereas working people see the issues of socialism? There's a lot of data that's come out. You guys will throw cold water on it if it's not true, that seems to show that truly poor people and working class people and rich people, richer people, went for Cuomo, and kind of the middle and highly educated people, and especially white highly educated people, went for Mamdani. Kyla, what's going on there?
I think it is an aspect of, so like a lot of my work right now is kind of on the labor force for young people. And I think for those people, there's almost, I don't want to call it misaligned expectations, but like there's this expectation of predictable progress, like that you'll have this house and you'll have all this money and like you're going to progress through your career really fast. And so when all of that stops happening, you're like, oh, the system has totally failed. Whereas I think people on the other end of the distribution, or like, you know, the people who are in poverty or who are extraordinarily wealthy, they might be like more used to like how things are, and they didn't have maybe that expectation of striving. That's my pet theory. But I think that has something to do with it, is that like that group specifically is very unsatisfied because they had an expectation in their head that things would be quite different for them.
Tyler, do you agree with that?
Absolutely. I think the element of expectations is critical here. And people got spoiled because things were very good in America and still are. You know, I think when I entered the job market, to pull, you know, the old guy kind of story out of the hat, but there basically were not high-paying jobs. Not in finance. It was poorly paying. Tech jobs as high-paying did not exist. Maybe you could think about becoming a doctor, a notion that I hated. And when I got my first job and was paid $40,000 a year, I was thrilled. I was so happy. I know that's worth more today. But still, you have this sense of entitlement. You come out of Harvard or Yale. There's hot jobs in consulting, law, tech, and finance. That's a pretty new thing, but it is going to make it harder for people who end up priced out.
I want to pick up on this idea of like the chasm between expectation and reality, because Tyler, this is sort of the foundation of the argument you make in your essay today, where you talk about how, you know, social scientists, economists, you know, going back to Hayek, Milton Friedman, and others have always been trying to explain what draws people to socialism, why it's the idea that won't die. And you make the argument that there's something particular happening right now. It's not unique to America. It's not unique to this time and place. It happens a lot, but it's basically a question of vibes. It's a question of mood swings. Here's what you write. Socialism is surging right now because American society has simply turned more negative. We complain more, we whine more, and we're more likely to dislike each other. And if we're more negative, it means we're more negative about everything around us, including capitalism. Big business has never been bigger, and we've never spent more time with it, whether it's scrolling on our smartphones, calling up an Uber, or flying to another city. Consider, you write, the kinds of socialist doctrine we see in the public sphere today. The core message is negative, and much of the hostility is directed toward billionaires. Zora Mamdani says that billionaires should not exist. In other words, it's more about tearing down the rich than raising up the poor. And you call this negative emotional contagion. Explain this theory to people who haven't yet read your essay.
This is very influenced by Kyla, though I'm not suggesting she agrees with everything I said. We've had a bunch of very bad events in American history, most recently COVID, the great financial crisis, the second Iraq War, 9/11. Some of them were based on serious mistakes, but some of it was just bad luck, like that COVID came along when it did. That was luck, came from China. People, of course, become more negative when very bad things happen. And there's something about negative sentiment, especially across people. Like, you see this in failing organizations. It feeds on itself and it becomes stronger and people become more negative. Or you can see it, say, in Twitter interactions. And I feel that society as a whole is at one of these points. I don't think it will last forever, but we may need some kind of shock to our system to get out of it. And man, you go online, people, to me, do seem much more negative than they did 10 years ago.
Kyla, do you agree with that? And anything to add?
Yeah, I mean, Tyler, you linked to Stephanie Stancheva, who's over at Harvard, her new paper on, like, things have literally gotten more negative online. And she has a couple other, like, stellar papers on zero-sum thinking, particularly among this sort of managerial class and how it's really becoming, like, a winner-take-all type of environment. And she also has a really interesting paper on the decline in upward mobility in the United States. And so I think there's some data to back the so-called negative vibes that are happening. And people are trying to find an outlet for it. And so they find an outlet in somebody like Mamdani, who clearly, you know, he does care. Like, he is out there in New York talking to New Yorkers. And so I think people are funneling that negativity into somebody like him. But yeah, there's a lot of, like, tear it down mentality across both sides right now.
And that there's, let's say, less sex and more porn is possibly another example of the same phenomenon.
Draw that out. Explain it.
As best we can measure it, younger people, possibly older people as well, they're having less sex. That seems crazy to me. Like, that's what younger people are for, in a way, right?
Less drinking, too.
Less drinking, which...
But isn't that connected to the economic problems? My anecdotal perception, watching this, and especially hearing from a lot of young women that work at the Free Press about their experiences, which is worthy of a book in and of itself, is that the top 1% of men get all of the women. And then everyone sort of lower than that in the dating pool can't get laid. And in part, that's because the women are not choosing them. They want, you know, whether this is because of evolution or cultural conditioning, I don't really care. They want men that can provide for them, men that are impressive, men that can make money, men with resources. And men can't get laid, fundamentally, they might argue, because they're not making enough money. What do you make of that theory?
I'm trying to remember, there was a data point that, of course, I'm not remembering, but essentially it was talking about how younger women are dating upwards. Like, a lot of, like, more young women have a partner than young men. And it's primarily because, and you would think it'd be, like, relatively equal because they'd be dating each other, but a lot of young women are dating older. And part of that, I do think, ties into your point about the want for resources, like the want for stability. And it is an unfortunate thing. Like, the dating discourse is happening again on Twitter, where people are talking about, unrealistic expectations that women might have. There is another interesting study that, you know, women want somebody who's, like, I think over 6'1", primarily. So it is, again, I think, a case of misaligned expectations. But then it creates all these downstream effects where you have a group of very unhappy young men who are trying to find an outlet, and they find it in the manosphere, or they find it within porn or another vice, and you get the political situation that we're in now. So I think everything does become a domino in that sense.
So let's talk a little bit about this, because Tyler, you write in your piece that you know, it's not just sort of the left that's going more extreme. It's certainly the right, and that they have this kind of symbiotic relationship. Explain what's happening on the right, because there's certain arguments that are coming out of the right that sound, if not socialist, nationalist populist, nationalist socialist. Tyler, explain the relationship between the two, if you could.
The right has turned anti-free trade, anti-globalization, just in general, anti-voluntary interaction. The president should be the semi-authoritarian figure. Those are all ideas from the bad side of the old left, and they're moving to the right. And people adhere to them with such an emotional fervor and such a negative feeling. You know, owning the libs is the phrase you hear. And you know, the people on the left are doing supposedly so many things to destroy America. It used to just be you disagreed with them. And now the emotional tenor is so negative. And I think that's very bad for our nation.
It's also the, you know, what people call the horseshoe theory, right? You see a picture of Lena Khan and Steve Bannon sort of like literally with their arms around each other, or Bernie Sanders and Trump sort of both putting forward protectionist policies. How do we break this cycle? Because it feels very like swirling the drain. It feels very, I don't know what the right metaphor is, very cyclical, very impossible, frankly, to like break the cycle. How do we do that?
It depends who the we is. So if the we is you, you start the free press and you give a different point of view. But just as a single individual, I feel what you do is you cultivate a good temperament and try to interact with people from many different groups and ages and nationalities. You try to make social media a good thing rather than a destructive thing. That's something Kyla has been phenomenally successful at. And you just keep on seeking out positive interactions and hope that your productivity and good attitude will shine through and win the day. There's no guarantee it's going to work, but you just have to keep on trying. And you can do it. I'm actually optimistic. But my goodness, you get out there every day and you see how tough it is.
So then what makes you optimistic?
The number of talented people I see today, including young people, I would say especially young people, I think in the world has never, ever been higher or even close to its current level. And my gut intuition is that will ultimately overwhelm the other forces. But look, that's an open question. Well, Kyla's 28. She's from Kentucky. She's phenomenally famous, has the super positive impact. And that was not possible, you know, 20 years ago or even 15 years ago. So I'm going to bet on that.
Kyla, do you feel as bullish about Tyler as the about the future?
I feel bullish about Tyler, and I also feel bullish about the future too. I think like, you know, every time, so I'm doing a lot of work on like attention as infrastructure and like speculation and gambling and like all of these things that are really haunting people, right? And I think right now we have treated young people as like a test generation. So we have thrown literally everything at them, and we're starting to learn from that. Like phones are starting to be banned from schools, which I think is a good thing. And I think we're learning slowly, like how we have to integrate things like AI into education. We have to treat social media. We have to treat attention as infrastructure, not just like this, you know, market type thing that everybody can bid on and the most enraging things will get all the attention. So I think we're slowly learning what's going to work. And I think we will lean back. The pendulum always swings. I think things will realign eventually. I think things will be okay ultimately.
Ultimately, right? That's the word.
Sounding sanguine. So I want to bring in a question from one listener on this call, Richard. He says this: are you guys blaming young people for their concerns on the alarming wealth gap that keeps growing? And I'll just add to that, I'm reading this book by Evan Osnos, the journalist, The Have and the Haveyat, which I think is a great title. And there's just some like unbelievable statistics in this book, like 25 hedge fund managers make more money than all of the kindergarten teachers in America combined. As of 2019, America's 400 richest individuals owned about $3 trillion in wealth, more than all Black households and a quarter of Latino households combined. I could go on and on and on. So let's answer Richard's question. You know, young people see this. They see the, you know, what's been called, people talk about it as the wealth gap, just the incredible inequality, and they feel very dissatisfied. let's contend with that. Are you guys blaming young people for their concerns on the alarming wealth gap that keeps growing?
I don't think it's a matter of blame. I would point out that income inequality has been going in reverse for some number of years now. I think AI will drive this trend all the more. So right now, a poor person who can afford, you know, $20 a month can get high quality free legal advice, medical advice, education in many things. So AI, I think, will largely have egalitarian effects.
If that's true, why do people not feel that way? This is a thing that always comes up with, you know, a lot of Steven Pinker's argument. Like, you know, we've never been wealthier. We've never had more opportunity. You guys know all the arguments. But people read those stats and they think, nah, either it's not, it just feels irrelevant to them. Why is that? If what you're saying is true, why does it not actually resonate emotionally for a lot of people?
Some of that is expectations, and some of that is what Rob Henderson calls luxury beliefs, that you have enough comfort in your life that you can start worrying in a way that someone, say, in a Mumbai ghetto does not worry because they're struggling to make it still. And you can go to poorer countries and see levels of happiness that are not so terrible. People are more focused on trying to get ahead than their own problems. And there is something self-destructive in the human psyche that when things are fine, they're not actually quite fine after all. Oh, we need to learn how to deal with that better. But I don't think it's about blaming anyone or young people. We all have these flaws. We need in part to accept them, to move forward with them.
Kyla, anything you want to add there?
No, I mean, I hope it hasn't come across as blame at all. So I wrote this piece a bit ago called Gen Z and the End of Predictable Progress, where I outline, you know, sort of my beliefs on what young people are facing. And it is an uphill battle economically with like housing, career progression, as I've been talking about, you know, sort of how do you enter the labor force? So I think it is blame, like Tyler said. I think it is sort of this new economy, and we're in a transition period with AI where we're all trying to figure out exactly what that's going to do and how that's going to integrate with jobs, and like, will it be a complement or will it be a replacement? And so I think there's that underlying tension to everybody too, where you're hearing these companies that like Mark Zuckerberg spending all this money on, you know, getting all these people in, and, you know, is this going to truly replace everybody? He's spending so much money, like it probably will, right? Maybe. And so I think young people are just trying to navigate that. And then you have social media, which amplifies all of these things. And so I think a lot of the feelings that young people have are warranted, but I totally agree with Tyler that we have to really figure out how to navigate them. Wealth inequality is a big issue, and we're about to have this massive wealth transfer that is probably going to exacerbate some of the problems that we're facing now. And, you know, the big, beautiful bill is, you know, going to probably exacerbate things a bit more. So I don't think it's blame at all. It's just, it's more questioning, well, how do we make the system fairer, if that is even the right word for it?
This is the most volatile time in my entire life, whether you think it's going to go well, go badly. And that affects people. That's reality, right? Nothing we should blame anyone for.
Kyla, one of the things that you've done a lot of research into is the attention economy. First, I want you to define what that is. It's a phrase that gets thrown around a lot. And I want you to connect, if you can, how the attention economy specifically leads people to charismatic politicians, incredibly adept at TikTok and other platforms like Zora Mamdani. So first, what is the attention economy for people that are less familiar or just hear it get referenced? And how does it connect to the rise of people like Mamdani?
Yeah, I mean, I think the attention economy is the world online. So social media, all of the things that we interact with and get information from, and that monetize the way that we interact with those systems. So Twitter, Instagram, et cetera. And I think the reason that, you know, Trump and Mamdani have done so well is because they're both masters of the attention economy. They're both incredibly charismatic, you know, they're funny, and they've been able to use the tools in front of them to get their message out. And so right now, it's like a sad reality in some aspects that if you're a politician and if you're not posting on social media, people aren't really going to know what you're all about. Like, you have to use the tools of the attention economy in order order to spread your political message. And that creates all sorts of strange incentives where it's much easier to go viral if you're being extreme or, you know, inducing outrage. And so that's kind of the situation that we're in, is the attention economy is driving more and more of the political economy.
And was Andrew Cuomo's, you know, cardinal sin of maybe several in this race that he believed he could sort of run a Joe Biden from the basement campaign, you know, float on his name recognition and didn't appreciate or understand how much the game had changed?
Yes, I believe he was running cable TV ads, which probably works for some segments of his base. But he wasn't walking New York. Like, he wasn't making videos of him going to various shops and talking to actual New Yorkers. Like, the Mamdani campaign is an excellent example of, I think, where politics is headed, with both the bad and the good that comes with it.
Okay, I want to get to several listener questions. I'm going to start with this one from Lori. Tyler, does Zohran's win in this primary race reflect a more general trend towards stronger state control, manifesting in socialism on the far left and perhaps even fascism on the far right?
I don't expect stronger state control to result from New York City, even assuming he goes on to become mayor. What I think you'll see is some efforts on his part to weaken the police force, voter dissatisfaction, a higher degree of chaos. The city festers a bit more, and ultimately state governance in New York City becomes weaker in a bad way. I think that's often what you get. So Trump, there's plenty of bluster, but along with that comes a lot of unpredictability, and it just becomes harder and harder for him to enforce his will on events, whether you like what he's trying to do or not. So I think the danger of all the socialism, you know, nationalist right-wing populism, is you end up with states that are not strong enough to do the things they ought to be doing.
Question from Corbin. Is there anything Republicans can learn from Zohran Mamdani's success? Kyla, I'll put that one to you.
I mean, I think it's, as I've said, you know, I think far too many times at this point, Trump is the inverse. Like, they're the opposites of each other. And so Trump won the young vote primarily by messaging on economic problems, which is also how Mamdani won it, was messaging on affordability. And so I think that's the big thing, is like, people just want things to be a little bit less expensive. Like, they want to be able to not have to worry so much. And so I think that's a lesson that both sides can take, is like, message to what people actually care about, you know, the message a bit more to the center, and that's affordability.
Okay, from Riley. Tyler, to you, since it might give you an opportunity again to shit on the greatest city in the world, is the Mamdani effect being blown out of proportion? It's a primary in a mayoral race in one city, and Cuomo is a uniquely terrible candidate. Are we making too much of this win?
I agree with that question. I don't think it represents a fundamental shift in American thinking. I do think there was already a general trend toward more populism on the left and the right. Some people say the Republicans should be the happy ones. You want your opponents to win in the cities where they can't do that much damage, but where they'll really look bad, and everyone can then see they don't want that on the national level. So there's quite a good chance this is a gift horse for the Republicans.
Okay, here's a question from Tim. Is there an economic consensus on the effects of all price ceilings or just rent control? He asks, what about price floors like minimum wage laws?
I would say on minimum wage laws, opinion is sharply split. People disagree. Not a consensus. But on rent controls, there absolutely is a consensus.
Okay, Tyler, here's one more for you. This is from Ralph. In the last paragraph of your article, you say you're optimistic because America has recovered from past discord. And then you cite the Civil War. Do we have to wait for another one before we can all come back together?
I don't think we're anywhere close to having a civil war, but there is a rising level of conflict in the world today, and the notion that American involvement in a foreign war could be the thing that switches the mood back, I find quite plausible. I find that a horribly high price to have to pay if that's how it evolves. But in our past history, that often has been, for instance, after the Great Depression, what switched the mood back to something positive. So I would be aware of that at least, but it's highly, highly unpleasant, right?
Well, no civil war. I agree with that. But there is a rising level of political violence that feels to me not just received, certainly not received with just universal outrage, but that a lot of people are celebrating it. I think most obviously of Luigi Mangione allegedly shooting the United Healthcare CEO, but there are lots of other examples. In that particular case, he was celebrated as, you know, as righteous. What are we to make of that? Should we be sort of kind of like a Robin Hood figure, I guess? And I'll give one example of this that really, I don't want to say flip me out, but really struck me about our cultural moment. I was on a flight to New Orleans and I was seated next to a guy and I thought he was wearing like a Backstreet Boys shirt or like the Jonas Brothers. And I looked more closely and it was just different photos of Luigi Mangione with like hearts all over them. And many people, including one of the flight attendants, came up to this guy wearing the shirt and was like fist bumping him. And I was like, he's wearing the shirt of a guy that murdered another person. And that didn't seem to be like striking people. It seemed like they were celebrating a just figure. Should we be sort of girding ourselves for more of that, Tyler?
I fear we are re-entering an age of political assassinations. I grew up at such a time. It was always a mystery to me why they ever went away. If you are crazy or willing to die or sacrifice your life, it is a way you can have a big impact. And with drones, I'm all the more worried. This is a major concern. And I think there's plenty of evidence that it's heated back up again. And again, there's a kind of contagion effect. For a while, we switched into serial killers, say in New York City. That now has dwindled. It's maybe too easy to catch them with DNA evidence. And it's back to assassination. Highly worrying.
Okay, I'm not letting us end on political assassinations. I want to end on something productive to take the lesson from Tyler's column today. What are the actual solutions to some of the real problems that young people are reacting to? Whether it's housing costs, insane costs of living in major cities, and maybe the answer, Tyler, is move to Kentucky or Ohio, college debt. If socialism isn't the answer, if protectionism from the right isn't the answer, what is the answer? Give us a few positive, forward-looking policies that people can look into. Kyla, can we start with you on this one?
I mean, I've been thinking about this problem for a while because it's much easier to diagnose problems than it is to come up with solutions. But I think like some of the, you know, hard tech investment that's been going on is promising. Like a lot of companies are looking at perhaps some of the climate issues that we're facing and saying, okay, we can fix this. Some of the housing problems that we're facing, how can we build homes faster, more ecological? And so I'm hopeful that like from an infrastructure perspective, we can start to be a bit more efficient and address some of the pressing problems with housing that we're going to increasingly have with energy because of AI. And that I think is something to be hopeful about. And that is, you know, private markets solving problems.
Tyler, let's end with you.
If you look, say, at higher education, you find this classic mix of restricted supply, subsidized demand, third-party payment. Whenever we try that mix in American life, it turns out badly. What our schools should be doing is teaching us how to work with AI. They're mostly asleep on that case. They keep on just going, 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 not changing, very static mentality. And we support the whole mess with a lot of subsidies and third-party payment. So we need to fundamentally rethink how we're doing higher education and many other parts of our policy and economy.
Tyler Cowen, Kyla Scanlon, I hope you'll come back. Always a pleasure to have you. And thanks all of you for joining us. See you soon.